Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author. She is senior correspondent for The Intercept, a puffing writing fellow at Type Media Center, and is the inaugural Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University. Ooh, Naomi Klein has it going on, baby. We haven't seen each other in a long while. We haven't been face-to-face since the campaign, and then all hell has broken loose.
Since Texas, I think.
That was it. Yep. And all hell has broken loose, depending on, or heaven, depending on how you want to look at it. I think people will say hell since March, and a lot of people have been holding in place. So I just want to check on you. What are you focusing in on now? What are you thinking about? What's going on?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's so good to hear your voice, Nina, and to reconnect. And I'm really glad you're doing the podcast to keep some of the conversations going that we began on the campaign trail. And I also really, I feel like people who were deep in the Sanders campaign, and nobody was in deeper than you and the senator, I think there's a unique kind of whiplash that these past few months have felt like, because it was such a high and then just such a crash, you know. I remember there was some sort of like challenge going on social media a few months ago where they were asking people to share like the most recent like photographs from when things were normal pre-COVID. And all of my photographs were from the campaign. and yeah, I feel like the high point, like for me, the real high point was being in Las Vegas on the day of the victory and just like what that felt like. And then just everything after that moment, just getting worse and worse and worse. But at the same time, I think the racial justice uprisings, the huge demonstrations, standing up for Black lives, and people leaving their lockdowns to fight for justice was pretty exciting as well. Even though, obviously, what sparked it is so horrific. But I feel like that multiracial youth-led movement is a lot of the energy that we felt on the campaign trail too, right? And when politics doesn't provide a possible way of change, people are going to take to the streets, and they need to. And it's not an either or, we need both.
We absolutely do. You know, you bringing up the movement for Black Lives and how young people are taken to the streets and pulling what I would call more seasoned people with them. You made me think about how you have certainly not only was one of the, what I would say, foremothers of the Green New Deal. You really push really hard in how you present what the greening of the world will look like. You always make the link between the intersectionality of climate change, racism, inequality, and this pandemic has made it so crystal clear that that intersectionality is real and that it needs to be dealt with in an intersectional way. Do you think this moment provides us the opportunity to take on your challenge?
The pushback before COVID was always, well, look, people don't, you know, America's not going to embrace huge change of the kind that a Green New Deal represents in the absence of a crisis. And of course, there was a crisis before the crisis, right? And there are multiple crises before what gets what gets defined as a crisis is really about power. And we know that there were many intersecting crises before COVID, and that's why the campaign was calling for a political revolution. But I heard a lot, and I think the Sanders campaign heard a lot of, like, people don't want a revolution. You know, people want incremental change, right? And especially after Trump, you know, people want a kind of a steady as she goes kind of change, right? And I think that I understand the appeal of that. You know, I understand the fear of that sort of sudden change after so much tumult, right? And after so much trauma. You know, I remember being in one of the caucuses in Las Vegas and hearing from some Biden supporters, you know, we love Bernie, but can't we just sort of have a transition period after Trump? Like, can't we just kind of all catch our breath, you know? And so I think, you know, when it comes to climate, we know we don't have that change, that time, right? We know we can't, we have to move fast, you know, and we have to be willing to change everything. And that's what a Green New Deal represents. And I think that the fact is that if all your economic indicators are relatively good, if unemployment rates are low, if the economy is growing, it's harder to get people to fathom that kind of change. And so the moment we're in right now, where all the systems are collapsing and we have a massive unemployment crisis and nothing about our economy is working for the vast majority of people, the kind of bold vision that a Green New Deal represents, where we are forced to reimagine how we live, how we think about housing, what we want from education, healthcare, and of course, energy and transportation, I think that is now understood as the only scale of change that will actually get us out of the economic crisis and the pandemic and provide an opportunity for the kind of racial justice reckoning that our moment demands as well. You know, when you call for a defunding of the police, right, it's really a very deep discussion about what the resources of where the resources of society should go. And it requires a huge investment in the infrastructure of care and then the kinds of communities we have, which is what we're talking about when we talk about a Green New Deal. So, I mean, look, Nina, obviously you and I both hoped for a different situation. You know, we wanted there to be a presidential campaign that was talking about the policies that we need and was talking about laying out a political process that would pick up these movement demands and translate them into policy. And that's obviously not where we are with Biden. But I think zooming out and thinking about the macroeconomics of the moment and, you know, what are the conditions historically that have produced catalytic change? They are moments of trauma like this. They are the Great Depression. They are the post-Civil War reconstruction. They are the Second World War mobilizations. In that sense, I think in that sort of sweep of history, we are in a better moment than we were in terms of imagining the scale of change.
When our comfort zone is no longer comfortable and for a mass number of people, and that is really what COVID has done. I mean, certainly blinders should be off if we didn't recognize it before, we recognize it now. And I love when you talk about the whole recognition that people like you and I and so many others who are leaders in this movement or in fellowship or sistership in this movement who understand that there was or were crises before this particular crisis, and who gets to describe what's a crisis depends on the power. And that is such an important point that I just want us to marinate in for a little bit. The Green New Deal itself, the very saving of our planet, of Mother Earth, is something that all nations have to take on. We have to be able to do that together. And what a mighty experiment that would be, Naomi, to have world leaders of nations, both large and small, come together and say, we're going to take on a Green New Deal. We're going to do it together. And here are the parameters. Here's how we get this started. I mean, certainly with the current president, that is not going to happen. He does not play well with others. He doesn't even play well in his own country. But that's another discussion for us. Do you think that we could have, from the grassroots leadership to leadership that is elected, a push for that kind of visionary change that will actually take the world by storm in a very positive way to save ourselves as we save Mother Earth?
We have to work towards it. I mean, what choice do we have, right? And I think one of the strengths of the Green New Deal as a frame is that it harkens back to the original New Deal with all of its profound exclusions and failures, and also its successes. I mean, the original New Deal is the reason we have Social Security and unemployment insurance. It electrified much of rural America. And it systemically discriminated against African Americans, against women, against many immigrants. And these are not flaws. They were deliberate. They were political decisions that were made. And I think that the Green New Deal from the onset was an attempt to repair the exclusions of the original New Deal, among other things. But the New Deal was an economic stimulus program in the midst of the Great Depression, in the midst of the Dust Bowl, at a time when only those sorts of sweeping changes had any hope of pulling the United States out of depression. And even so, it wasn't bold enough, you know, and there was huge push from social movements and sit down strikes and general strikes, pushing for bolder stimulus spending. And it wasn't until the Second World War and the vast spending in the context of the Second World War that the U.S. was finally and decisively pulled out of an economic depression. And, you know, we are in this moment where globally every country in the world is in an economic crisis. Every country needs to fashion some kind of economic stimulus. And one sign of hope, I would say, Nina, is that if we think back to 2008, 2009, after the financial crisis, the global financial crisis, climate was really pushed off the agenda. You know, there were a few of us who were pushing for a Green New Deal style response to that economic crisis. But instead, we got brutal economic austerity around the world. And now I think there's very much a different mood where, you know, in Europe and at a subnational level in parts of the United States, you have a very clear vision to say, okay, we don't have just one crisis. We have many crises. And if there's something that COVID has taught us, it's that we have to stop telling ourselves that the worst won't happen. The worst may very well happen. And I think that mindset that allowed people to just kind of reassure themselves about climate, like, oh, maybe it won't happen, or maybe it won't happen during my lifetime, you know, maybe we'll be okay. I think people get that we're not going to be okay, that like all the debts are coming due. And we actually have to listen to scientists, and we have to, you know, ground our policy in reality. And so I think we have opportunities to multitask, right? To think about a Green New Deal in a way that is really rooted in the Black Lives Matter analysis around defunding the carceral state, including the military, moving resources over to deep investments in care and repair. And I think this needs to happen globally. You know, there's something really interesting that's happening around COVID that it's like we're being told to slow down. And every time we try to speed back up, every time we put our foot back on that accelerator marked business as usual, the virus comes surging back. Have you noticed this?
I have noticed that. Yes, it is forcing us to slow down. I totally agree that for some of us, it's God. For others, it's the universe. You know, call it what you will. But yes, the universe is speaking to us as humankind and telling us we got to do things a different way, because the way that we've been doing things is absolutely not working. And not only is it not working, it's killing us, literally.
And if you think about like the business proposals for how to deal with the virus, right? they are offering people what they had before the pandemic, only much worse, right? It's all like it's not going back to normal. It's going back to worse than normal, like a much more dehumanized normal without the relationships that make work bearable in so many ways, right? So I feel like it's this tremendous challenge of really thinking much more creatively about how we use these years. Because it may be 2 years that we're talking about before there's a vaccine that actually rolls out at anything like the scale we need. And I think we need to think of these as the years of repair, you know, repairing our relationships with each other, doing that hard historical reckoning, the rendezvous with history that has been delayed and postponed and denied for centuries, and having a realignment where getting the economy going doesn't mean torching the planet. Because we're so out of alignment that getting the economy back to normal means putting our Earth back into crisis. And ourselves back into crisis. So that speaks to such a profound misalignment between the goals of an economy and the goals of people on this planet and all of life on this planet.
And so we can never go back to normal. I mean, going back to normal is totally unacceptable. So we have an awesome responsibility and also opportunity to reshape our new normal. And so when you say years that what this COVID and the impact that it is having on us, and if it's another 24 months, then we can use that as our years of repair. So I don't know, let the repairing begin, let the boldness begin, because you also talked about us being bold, and this is a opportunity for us to reflect and to be bolder, and not just, you know, name a lot of times people, I believe so many of us have ceded our power and our authority to elected officials. And what certainly you have shown in your work and so many other grassroots activists is that the power really is in the hands of the people. What would you say to folks right now who are feeling really overwhelmed, whether they're overwhelmed because they're unemployed or underemployed, overwhelmed about this moment because they're not seeing the boldness happen from elected leaders, even in the face of COVID? My God, we still have people running for president who don't understand that Medicare for All is not just this cute idea, that millions of people continue to suffer and we're adding to those roles and that we must have it. But what would you say to people who feel kind of powerless in this moment? They were feeling powerless before, but they feel especially powerless right now. How could you encourage them to find their power, to find that thing that they can do?
Well, it's such a tricky moment, because this virus keeps us more isolated than we need to be. You know, we need to find each other. That's one thing that all political organizers understand. We have to build power, and that means breaking isolation. And I think that was, to me, that was always the most beautiful part of the Sanders campaign, and why it was such a joy to be a part of it, was that not me, us feeling, and it going beyond the sort of not Bernie us, but also not me and my problems, but us, right? Like not like that my, what my unemployment or my medical debts or my student debts are not just my fault. They are a systemic created crisis. And when we find each other, we find that, that first of all, it's not a personal failing. And we also don't need to solve it by ourselves. There is power that can be won and earned when people get together who all have problems and make a problem for those in power. And so how do we navigate this virus that is, you know, how do we organize in the context of a virus that is telling us that we have to be careful about how much we are face to face with each other indoors? And how do we break that feeling of isolation? Like, people are listening to us alone, right? When they're not in a rally. I'm used to hearing your voice, you know, in front of thousands of people, and getting that energy back from the crowd, and that give and take where you realize that how much people agree with you, you know, and they realize how much everybody around them agrees with them. And it becomes an empowering experience, which is different than being alone and maybe having your headphones on and being all alone and thinking about your problems and getting overwhelmed, right? And so I think a big part of it is just remembering that even though we may be alone in this particular instance, we are not alone. The fact that Joe Biden is the presumptive nominee is not a reflection of the fact that a majority of voters are aligned with his brand of conservatism within the Democratic Party. People believed he was safe. They believed he was safe, despite many people disagreeing with his policies. They were looking for somebody who felt like a safe bet to beat Trump, and they landed on Biden. And there are all kinds of, you know, we could rehash this over and over again about the conditions that led to that calculation and whether it was right or whether it was wrong. But I think it is important to understand that it isn't reflecting where people are at politically. Where people are at politically is much more progressive than Joe Biden. And when we look at what the Movement for Black Lives has accomplished in shifting the debate over a matter of just a couple of months, where having serious discussion about defunding the police and closing prisons, is having to be debated on MSNBC and CNN and in the pages of the New York Times, I think that can happen during a Trump presidency should show us how much power there is in mass organizing. And that can happen in the context of outdoor demonstrations, and it can also happen online in the context of self-education and teaching, and it can happen in smaller gatherings as well if we're careful. I think, you know, personally, I think we should be making the most of summer and the fact that we can be outdoors more.
And it's healthier to be outdoors too. In terms of the COVID, it's better to be outside in open air than it is to be hemmed up inside.
Exactly. And we can do things together outdoors. We can talk, we can plan, we can organize. It doesn't have to just be, you know, going to go shopping and, you know, going to restaurants. I'm not saying don't do that, but we have to make good use of our face-to-face time in these months.
Absolutely we do. And this is awesome good news, because it just shows that no matter how things are reflecting, there's always the opportunity to do things different, to do them better, to have progress. We just have to have the mindset to see the opportunity. Sometimes it's opaque, you know, the opportunity is not as clear, it's opaque. And so you just got to kind of keep sifting through so that you can see. When you mentioned the Movement for Black Lives, that I believe it's important also for people to recognize that those seeds were planted years ago. And so what we're seeing now is the manifestation of the hard work that the movement has been doing for several years to get us to this moment. And then that spark happened. COVID happened. What happened to George Floyd happened, unfortunately. And it did lead to a spark that has forever not only changed our country, but the world. I mean, people are unifying around the notion of Black lives all over the world, Naomi, not just in the United States of America, and forcing people with special titles, whether it's elected titles or titles within corporations, to take a look and to do a new thing.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to think about why, you know, what it is about this moment that is different. You know, I'd love to hear your take on that. Like, why this breakthrough? Why now? Do you have a theory there?
I don't know. It's a confluence of things, because you and I know racism been in place since the inception of this country, anti-blackness, the inception of this country, the kind of suffering, whether it's being unemployed, underemployed, not having enough health insurance, environmental racism, a criminal justice system that has needed to be reformed for many generations. All of those things were always swirling in our environment, and you had different leaders at different times raising the various issues. And here we have the COVID, as you've laid out, and then George Floyd. People are unemployed. They are fed up. They understand personally now, whichever side they're on, that the way things are working is not really working for them, their families, their communities. And I believe it was the confluence of all of those things happening all at once that caused this uprising to happen.
And I agree. And I think that, you know, in the aftermath of, or in the midst of disasters, when you have a real disdain for life expressed, it can be very radicalizing, you know, and I think people saw that in the eyes of George Floyd's murderers. And, you know, I think about Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria and the uprising that eventually forced the governor to resign. It was sparked by these leaked text messages where, you know, after many months of suffering in the aftermath of Maria, but as we all know, there are always crises before the crises and crises before those, but and a layering of all of that, the sort of the last straw was this text chain where government officials were making jokes about the bodies of people who were you know, left out in the open after Hurricane Maria. And it was just sort of seeing in black and white the total disdain for life, that was just too much. And you never, I guess the point is, you can never predict when the moment will be that people just say enough. We will not put up with it anymore. And all the serious people up until that moment will be telling you, oh, no, people don't want a lot of, you know, they don't want deep change. They don't want a revolution. Everything's fine. Incremental this, incremental that. And then something will happen and it will just be enough. And it will only be deep change that anybody is interested in talking about. And I think for those of us who are part of the Sanders campaign, it's like we also have to just be honest. It took me a while, be honest with you, for the first couple months, I think I was just deeply depressed. And I was like, why aren't I being more productive? Why can't I do this? Why can't, and I just finally admitted to myself how sad I was. That I'm sure, because I think that for those of us who tasted it, you know, in those moments, like in Las Vegas, you know, when the people who make that city work, who shine the slot machines, you know, who ferry the gamblers to and from the airport as Uber drivers, who know the lie behind the dream, came out from the shadows and said, no way, you know, we are voting for something different, and gave Bernie that decisive victory on the Las Vegas Strip of all places, you know?
The union bosses made it seem as though they would never go for, you know, Medicare for all, that all was lost. They came through, and they came through for themselves and their futures. They defied the quote unquote bosses and were very much in line, Naomi, as you and I both know, with the people across this country, with our, see, we're no longer radical I don't know what we're going to do then. We're not radical. We're right in line with the majority of our sisters and brothers in this country who really do want a new deal across the board, whether it's environmental or racial, political, social. They really do. And, you know, I'm looking at the cover. I have your newest, your latest book.
But we did, Nina. We got outplayed. We got outplayed. And so, you know, what do we do with the fact that we know we could have won? That's what's hard. It's really hard. And figuring out why we didn't. We need a lot of honesty. We need our own repair and reckoning. And because we can't repeat those mistakes. We can't. You know, and there's always, in the same way that in American history, you're only ever allowed to look forward and never back, you know? No, forward. There's no history. Every day is brand new. We can't have that within our movements. We have to be allowed to have real postmortems, because how else will we not repeat these setbacks that have so much at stake? Yeah, sorry.
No, the postmortem, that word came to mind when you were talking about that. You have to know, you know, James Baldwin once said, know from whence you came. And so we can overlay that on what you and I are talking about. We have to understand the path we came from to understand where we are going. And that takes some courage to do that, though, to really to self-assess, to be self-aware and to assess what went right, what went wrong, what could have been done differently, because you are absolutely right. We could have won.
And I think that's a question for those of us who are part of the Sanders campaign, but it's a question for the sort of progressive coalition more broadly too. People who didn't join Sanders, but didn't support Biden either. So how do we keep this from happening again? Because the stakes are just too damn high. So we can, you know, we can put the best face forward about what movements can do, and we can talk about what we can get done at the city level and at the state level and at the regional level. And there are some really exciting things happening around sort of Green New Deals for New England or for the Pacific Northwest, and that's great, and we need to do that, but we can't give up on the national either.
No, we cannot, and we have to find a way to do all of those things at the same time. Well, I have in front of me a book in red, and it says on, and there's fire, the burning case for a Green New Deal, written by the magnificent Naomi Klein. And one of your colleagues in all things green calls you the intellectual godmother of the Green New Deal. That is none other than Bill McKibben. And so talking to you, Naomi, just made me think about how we could take the cover and the title of your book, On the Burning Case for a Green New Deal, On the Burning New Case for the Burning Case for Medicare for All, On the Burning Case for Criminal Justice Reform, On the and we can go on and on. I mean, that's it. Let's be on. And there's a burning case for so many of the issues that will have transformative, or the issues that will make for transformative change in the lives of everyday people. So you and I are on. Let's be on.
And, you know, that fire, right, it's a reminder that the world was on fire before this fire. But it should also, I think, invoke our own fire, right? That fire, that burning fire, that healing fire, because there is a kind of a clearing away of debris that, you know, fire, when it's healthy, you know, does. It just it makes room for new growth, for new life, and I think that may be the moment we're in right now, where our movements are on fire, and they are in the streets, and they are getting really focused on what is the core, what is the nucleus of the of the new world that we are going to build together. And it's, you know, it's such a complicated moment politically, Nina. Like there's so much to feel regret about, and there's so much grief. And there's those, you know, that you realize that history has all of these could have been moments, those where you know, it's not inevitable that a society goes in one direction. It's a, it's just a series of decisions that are made by real people.
have a real impact, real consequences, but we definitely need to take not only a page from your latest book, but just go ahead and take the cover and be on fire for Vernon Case, and then you just fill in the blank.
For all of it.
Yes. Now, how can people find you? You have taken a little bit of a hiatus from social media. You and I were talking about that a little bit, how it does the body and the mind good.
You can't find me on Twitter. You can't find
Jesus. Twitter is a dangerous place at times. It can be used for good, but it can also be used for evil. But in terms of your website and other places where people can find out what you're doing and what you're up to, where should they go?
Yeah, well, people can go to naomiklein.org, and I have a an organization I co-founded called theleap.org, which is sort of a proto-Green New Deal, because we do need to leap. We need to, it's not going to be small steps that are going to get us where we need to go. And so those are the places, and yeah, I am taking a little break from social media because I am tired of screens, and I want to try to be present in the corporeal world for a while, and just kind of recharge and refocus and do some writing. And I have been finding that those spaces are not, you know, they can trick you into believing that it's the whole world and that's where people's heads are at. And you know, we, like everything else, we need to use social media as the powerful tool that it is, but we can't let it colonize our brains, because that's just so dangerous. And I was just really finding that in this moment of more social isolation that I think is good for us, having social media replace that is just, it's never healthy. But I think in the absence of those more face-to-face relationships, it was really starting to have a bad effect on me. So that's why I stepped back for a little while. And I just say that because I feel like anybody else who's getting down on social media should do the same. Use an app called Freedom and block Twitter for 24 hours at a time.
Amen to that. I'm going to have to follow your lead on that, my dear sister, because it is very toxic, and it can be all consuming, and it does make you feel like the entire world is in Twitter, and it's not. It really is not. It's a much bigger, broader, bolder world than what is on Twitter. So yes, detox is what comes.
I sure knew that in the Sanders campaign, where they tried to make Twitter the face of the Sanders campaign, and anybody who was on the campaign and met the wonderful, generous, and just incredibly humane people who made up the campaign knew what a gross distortion that was.
Very much so. Oh my God. So yes, we will have to come back together and have that conversation. And speaking of Leap, I know you've said of the people on Leap, of Leap, that they are a kick-ass team who work all day, every day to turn the vision that's in your book on fire, the burning case for a Green New Deal, to turn these pages into a lived reality for all of us. And that is what we are working on, a lived reality that edifies, that lifts, that causes growth and opportunity and beauty and love and hope. And we can have all of those things and still be challenged. The one and only Naomi Klein, it has been such a pleasure to be with you today. Hello Somebody is a production of the Large Media Network. Our logo and web design was created by Grace & Co. Special thanks to other members of the Hello Somebody team, Pepper Chambers and Tiffany Hale. If you want to join and support this show, become a member on Patreon. Search for Hello Somebody.